My name is Claire O'Connor and I'm joined this week by my co-host, Stefan O'Nolan, host of the Trademark Belfast podcast, and he is a part of Left Block. So The Week at Work is a part of Left Block. Left Block is a political education and media project. You can get more information about us at leftblock.ie. That's Left Block with a C. And if you'd like to support our work, you can find us on patreon.com/leftblock. And again, that's Left Block with a C. So we've had, for the past couple of weeks, we've had episodes from Conor McCabe, and we haven't had one of these Sunday kind of roundups of the news. And I think we're going to dive right in to the biggest story around the world, and has been the biggest story since October, and that is the continued bombardment and the genocide that's happening in Gaza. And I say in Gaza, it's extending to the West Bank. You know, the West Bank isn't actually getting that much coverage, but we know what's happening over there as well. Stevie, I'm going to just throw it out to you. We're seeing that the deaths are still rising every day. We're hearing about 10 children having their limbs amputated without anaesthetic every day. Where how, like, numbers have kind of lost all sense of meaning. We heard the other day one of the last hospitals in Gaza was bombed. And when you look back at the distraction and the absolute nonsense around the arguments about would Israel bomb a hospital, the very first one, and back, it really is back to the fog of war, how normalized this stuff becomes so quickly, and that they cause a distraction. Everybody gets caught up in the argument about what's true and what's not. And then within a week or two, they're doing the very same thing on a regular basis. So yeah, I just want to, on a really broad sense, like, what are you feeling about it all before we get into the actual stories?
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult at the moment, I think. I've got young kids, well, kids in teens and early 20s, and they're kind of suffering, I think, what you might call empathy fatigue. They kind of keep looking to me and saying, you know, when's this going to stop? Or what can we do about it? And how can this be allowed to continue? And it's very difficult to explain to young people, I find very difficult to explain to them why this is being allowed to continue, and why, you know, and the brutality of the world that we live in really is foregrounded to the point where it can be really depressing, I think, for younger people. Now, we've seen it before. We've seen it in other places. This isn't new, I suppose. Imperialism does this to maintain its power, I suppose. And so it's a real sharp lesson in how the world works for younger people, that we can sit by and people can live stream their own mass slaughter and no one does fuck all about it. Now, when I say no one does fuck all about it, I know there's marches, I know there's demos, I know that people are protesting and organized, and rightly so, but it's not stopping Israel's assault on Gaza, or indeed, as you said, on the West Bank itself. So it's a tough one. It's really hard, you know. The only thing we can do, of course, is to keep doing what we're doing, I suppose, protesting, marching, and staying online. The online battle is really important, I think. You can't really underestimate the propaganda war and how clearly, you know, Zionist Israel are losing that war at the moment. It's not to say they can't turn it round. So, yeah, it's a tough one, but just keep at it. I mean, if people think they're struggling here with empathy fatigue, or they get a little bit upset by seeing the bodies of dead children on Twitter, then try being in fucking Gaza for 5 minutes. So, you know, just keep with it, I suppose. All we can do at the moment. And putting pressure on your own state. That's where you can That's where you can levy political pressure, is where you are, where you stand, where you live, where you organise. So just keep putting pressure where you can, I suppose.
And on that, just on the online spaces, you shared an article with us actually, I think just yesterday, about how Israel had bought multiple, like a conglomerate of media and online tools, basically to up their game in terms of the information war, because they are losing it, and they're losing it in a spectacular way. And yet still, we're seeing this continue. How important do you think that's going to be going forward in terms of not just individuals in online spaces, but actually a coordinated, organized, well-funded, like, we need those tools that Israel have.
Yeah, I mean, I always find it interesting when people talk about in the mainstream media and then social media. Mainstream media has always been privately owned. You know, it's not a free press when it's owned by a few billionaires across the globe. Social media is no different. It's owned by billionaires, and billionaires will make sure that their interests are protected, you know, by using that platform for their own interests, the interests of the wealthy, the interests of imperialism across the world. And Israel, weirdly, has been central to that system for the last 10 years or more. I mean, it's Pegasus software. You know about the Pegasus software, the spying software that comes out of Israeli kind of military research and kind of that military industrial complex that exists in Israel, that the West are in partnership constantly. So it's no surprise that Israel's moved into the idea of, okay, we need to now buy an influencing system. We need to have a system that helps us control the debate, control the narrative, whether it's TikTok or whatever it is, Twitter, Facebook, all the various social media. So it's moved into that space. I'm surprised, not that it's moved into, it's in that space already, but it's decided to expand its power into that space. I mean, Israel was, you know, Cambridge Analytica, in the first sort of Trump election, we've all known about the power of social media to influence how people think. And you can see it. You can see it every day. And there's reams of research, including the one recently in the South, Iskrivi Talu, the one that talked about how that one of the stats was there are 300,000 far right Twitter accounts that claim to be Irish, but all come from the States. So, it's a really complex world to try to analyze and understand. But on the left, we need to understand that these people are using those platforms to really influence how people think about the world they live in. And Israel have just moved into that space because that whole kind of myth they built up at Hasbara about how they're brilliant at propaganda. I mean, that's been shown to be bollocks because they've brought this war. Also shows what we can do as well, though, by using those platforms to the best we can, by constantly liking and sharing and putting up posts of our own and try to dominate that space. Even though people are being shadow banned and fucked off TikTok and fucked off Twitter, it's important that we keep on there, keep liking things and sharing things and having that online battle, because it is an important battle, because it's a battle of ideas. And on the left, we've always been involved in that battle, the battle of ideas. It's just in a different format now, that's all. But it's not moved into that space to try and dominate it, try and colonize, if you like, that narrative.
And even what you were talking about there, there's been great advice about how to beat the algorithm, and that if if you're commenting on particularly, say, like the journalists and the new, like people who are once content creators and photographers who have become these voices of a genocide, like Motaz, and like young people who are now documenting what's happening to their own people. Actually, if you like comment daily, if you go on every day and you like comment and write a couple of sentences, you're actually contributing to keeping them safe, because the more visible they are, Israel know the level of, as much as they don't want them doing it, the level of outrage that will come if somebody like Mota, like who has millions and millions of people who are checking in with him daily, like their morning routine is they wake up, they check in. There's a good chance that actually, if we keep these people visible, that it might actually just increase their safety just a little bit. And just on the software that Stevie was talking about, so it's going to be AI as well. Again, it's weaponizing the new technology so that this AI technology can just be basically sent into the different kind of social media platforms and will be replying in real time, rooted in the ideology and the kind of misinformation campaigns that Israel want to set. So it's like it's a massive battle we're up against, but actually, we have real people who are rooted in empathy and rooted in commitment to social justice and rooted in commitment to opposing the genocide. And I think that as much as people are getting fatigued and are getting a little bit hopeless, like countries, like you said, we can challenge our own states. So we had 100,000 people on the street in Dublin last week. And yeah, and then we're having pop-up protests all the time, we're having direct actions. We don't have massive targets in this country. We don't have arms factories that we can go and try and shut down, so the state is really the biggest kind of power, the place we can have the most impact. We saw Leo Varadkar come out and undermine the idea of the ICJ case. So I have to say, for me, watching South Africa on the morning of the start of the 11th on the ICJ case, a country that has been colonized and has actually overcome apartheid, walking in there and taking it upon themselves to try and challenge Israel and what they're doing was really emotional. And I think people around the world like saw, and what we're seeing actually is that a lot of the global south, so we're seeing more and more countries now taking cases to the ICC, taking joining the South African case and committing to joining it after the initial judgment comes out. So like, for instance, there's a stop there motion on Wednesday in the Dáil down south about joining the ICJ case. We're going to have rallies outside. We're going to have a pressure campaign over the next couple of days. But like, regardless of what the Irish government say, and we've seen some bullshit about how we're one of the best countries in the world when it comes to supporting them. In action, we've done nothing. We've done absolutely nothing. So in practical terms, we haven't done anything. So until our government actually takes a stand, commits to supporting the ICJ case, commits to taking their own case, they're not using their positions and they're not using the leverage at all.
No, I mean, you don't expect anything different, do you, from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael? They'll do that. They'll protect their reputation. They won't want to annoy the EU. They won't want to annoy the Yanks, of course. They'll try and triangulate everything and make sure that they don't get found out for. So they'll, yeah, it's all rhetoric. That's all it's ever going to be from them. But you're right. The ICJ thing was really important, and it was you got this sense of hope, I suppose, a little bit when you watched that, the opening remarks particularly, which were brilliant. And of course, the ICC have, I mean, I think Mexico and Chile have taken or are taking a case to the ICC, to the International Criminal Court, which is, that's a different forum, obviously, and it's more about finding individual criminal responsibility. But all of that puts pressure on Israel. It puts pressure on the US and on imperialism generally. Not, I don't know if it'll have the impact. What it was a huge propaganda failure for Israel. I'm not sure it was a propaganda success, if you like, for Palestine, in the sense that, well, whether it will stop the bombardment and the mass murder and the genocide, but certainly was a failure for them. Like that hit them hard. So that's why it was good to see, where it goes next, who knows? But it's quite clear that Netanyahu, being obviously a sociopath and a fascist, is he, and I mean, the Yanks have lost control of him almost, and he knows politically that he's got nowhere else to go Like, if he stops this, that's the end of him politically in Israel, I think so. You've got this fucking madman, kind of let loose, and Gaza is becoming uninhabitable. The north of Gaza, apparently, reports are that, it's flattened almost literally, and I use that term correctly. And now they're blowing up. They have been doing it all the time. They're blowing up living spaces. They're blowing up tower blocks. They're blowing up people's homes, dotting their side of
Universities, I mean,
universities, mosques. So yeah, the idea that it's not an attempt to erase a nation, it is an attempt, and we can see it in real time. So where it goes, who fucking knows? But and the next debate now is all about two-state solution. Netanyahu came out last week and said there won't be a pact. He's been saying that for 20 years, and Israel's been practicing that for 70 years. There was never going to be a fucking two-state solution. Now, I understand that when I work with an activist, certainly for people from Palestine, they've always wanted to maintain that idea of the two-state solution because that's all they had. Now, politically, that was the focus, but we all know that that's gone. It's dead. It's fucking finished. So
And
what
even back
comes?
from something like this.
Well, the West holds on to, and even fucking that tosser Starmer yesterday talking about the importance of a two-state solution. They know it doesn't mean anything. It's just rhetoric, and that's why I can get away with saying it. But go on,
Yeah,
sorry.
like so what by saying that by claiming to hold on to something that they know won't happen, it just prevents them from having to actually do anything of substance, which is, I mean,
100%.
the very last thing I'll say on this as well is that because we haven't obviously done one of these for the past couple of weeks, when we saw the world, how quickly the world would mobilize after the Houthis attacked a couple of ships, but they didn't take a step for the death of tens of thousands of children and young people. And I just think that that says everything we need to know about what this is rooted in, and it's capitalism and imperialism, and it's the capitalist machine. And people are waking up to that and seeing it for the first time, and maybe realizing that actually it doesn't matter how out of step governments are with their people, that unless there is very visible physical enforceable action, we're the only people that can change anything really.
Yeah.
And on that, I suppose actually it leads into our elections coming up in the next couple of months, and what's going to be, I think, a really, really toxic and difficult discourse because of what's happened with the far right. And we've seen hotels being set on fire. Like the amount of arson attacks we've seen over the past maybe 2 months is just unthinkable when you think of I think the referendum on care and family that's gonna come up, which realistically is very disappointing for a lot of people, very disappointing in terms of what the changing of the word in the referendum. So it's gonna restructure the meaning of the word family, and it's gonna broaden it out and include, it's going to include families that aren't a man and a woman married with kids, but it had the opportunity to root an actual right to stay in the home, raise family, actual socioeconomic supports and justice. And it's not doing that. Again, it's as we expected, it's a really liberal, fluffy rewarding. But in saying that, the restructuring of the word family is still important, and it does matter. And most of us will still support it. What we will have is we will have the far right using it as a weapon and saying that it's another attack on family, as they do with every single referendum. So that's going to be an opportunity and a touch point for, really toxic language, toxic discourse, and really, attacks on different kind of family types. And then that's going to lead into the local elections. So we have a really shitty couple of months here in terms of violent
Yeah,
discourse.
one of the things that's interesting, I suppose, from a if you stand back from an academic point of view or a sociological point of view, is to see what happens to that vote in working class areas, particularly in urban areas. Because remember, during the marriage equality referendum, some of the highest votes for marriage equality referendum was in working class areas of Dublin and places. So it's really high, it's 80% or something. And there were other places like my own fucking county, Westmeath, where it was really low. I think it was actually the only one of the only counties that aren't voted against it in terms of percentages. It'd be interesting how that shifts and changes, because if people vote no for this referendum on that on a so really important social issue, therefore that the far right and that narrative is having an impact, like it's changing people's minds. So that would be an interesting kind of threshold to watch, and an indication of how deeply rooted those kind of toxic narratives are being shared in those communities. So it is a bit of a concern, it is a bit of a worry. But look, I mean, everything the state does is playing right into the hands of the far right, and again, make this point, everyone says it all the time, not everyone on all those marches is a fascist, far from it. People are worried, they're afraid, they're being made to be afraid, they're being controlled, they're being, all of that. But nonetheless, when you see marches and people say, well, this isn't a racist march, but the banner at the front of it says Ireland is full, well, then that there are far right actors controlling that, because who decides what banners are allowed and who leads these marches and stuff like that. So there's a lot of mealy-mouthed stuff about, oh, we're not racist, but we're going to come out with this fairly racist far right banner. But it is a difficult time, but the state's playing into their hands. Now, our question is, because we always make the point that, fascism isn't a working class phenomenon, it's a ruling class project. So you have to always find the links between, activists on the ground who are promoting far right narratives and ideas, and money, where it's coming from, how these things are funded, but also why the state's making the decisions without getting too conspiratorial, why the state's making the decisions it's making, you know, almost playing right into the hands of the far right. And I've always been of the opinion that if you're a Fine Gael strategist a couple of years ago and you're looking for ways to, you know, damage Sinn Féin's vote in working class areas, well, that would be the way to go. Because, you know, even, I think, well, there was one poll that showed that 60% of Sinn Féin voters had an issue with immigration. Everyone has an issue with immigration. It's an important topic. We need to discuss it sensibly, and we don't. And so if you're a Fine Gael strategist, you go, right, let's target that. Let's fuck up their vote in working class areas. How best can we do that? And so I imagine that, you know, without, again, without being conspiratorial, that's certainly part of the just you know, what's going on here.
Again, this isn't the first time you've seen this. This happens all over the world, and it's a pattern
Yeah.
that's repeated. So it's something that we can see coming, and a lot of us have been, you know, tracking this and working on when there were small groups of people, or when there were just singular
What and
voices
warning about it and waving
warning
red
about it, screaming
about
about it, like,
it.
which is why it was so frustrating then, say, after like the Dublin riots, you know, journalists who have been saying this isn't an issue for years then coming out and all of a sudden, like, you know, jumping on board, and in a really classist way as well, which is, I think, the what's really frustrating when you talk about the messaging around it. And also, if you look at, say, something like Ross Grey, it's like, how do you get a community to be so whipped up in hatred and fear that they are screaming at children walking in cover, like surrounded by guards? It's like, how even they have been there for days or weeks or however long they've been camping out. In their head, they have an idea of what's happening, and it's all the, you know, the language, the it's hundreds of military age, unvetted men. And what I think is so interesting is when you kind of juxtapose that with the Irish support for Palestine. You know, we have massive support for Palestine in this country. Do people ever take a second to stop and think, okay, well, what if they became displaced outside Palestine and they have to come here? Would we, like, what would your feeling be? What if it was Palestinian people coming here? Where would that support go? And I'd love people to, you know, I suppose run that thought fully through. But I think even around Ireland as well, we have enough empty homes in this country to house every single person on the streets, every single person in emergency accommodation, every single person in direct provision. But we don't, because of capitalism and because of neoliberal politics. Like, that's the reality. We
Well,
have,
they're going to do it because the government decides it doesn't want to do it, and that's the
yeah,
reality. It's made a political decision that we
bad
all have homes,
decisions.
and we're not going to give people homes. End of story.
Yeah.
It's a political decision. It's not, the government pretends as if they're neutral in all this, as if they have no power to change anything. But again, I don't think that's by mistake. I think they
No.
know, and they're playing a really dangerous game with it, a
Yeah.
really dangerous game.
And
That's
also they have an easy excuse then. They have an easy answer. Like, they can point to something else. Like, why would they be answerable when nobody's asking them the questions? If the anger isn't being directed at them, if the que like housing is not the biggest issue anymore in a country that has such a problem, like such a housing crisis, and has had for 10 years. I mean, much longer, it's obviously been developing. But like, we have 700, 800 asylum seekers sleeping rough. So people are actually coming into the country seeking asylum and ended up on the streets. Like, that's how bad things have gotten. But there's such a sense of apathy and a lack of empathy that actually that's not an issue for people. People don't care. Like, as in, on the whole, like, that's not where people's focus is, and that's not where and listen, the government rely on the sense of apathy, and they rely on us being distracted. Like, that's what happens. A lot of people are focusing on Gaza and only Gaza really for the past couple of months. And I know in terms of activists, we've kind of taken our eye off the ball in terms of the organization of the far right and the networks around the far right. And back to something that you have talked about in Trademark loads of times, and even touched on in terms of the information war, they are better at it than us. They're just better at it. Like, they give easy answers. They give communities an easy answer to a problem that is genuinely there. And, you know, they can whip people up. People are scared. People are like, there is a
But
genuine
if you, I mean,
resource.
if you think, yeah, if you were to think that, you know, that so many people in Ireland, particularly the last 15 years of austerity and so on, people are angry and people are frustrated, and that's true. I'm angry and frustrated,
Yeah.
and encouraging people and organizing a way for people to punch down rather than punch up is the oldest trick in the book, and that's all this is. This is organizing anger. This is directing anger away from where it should go, which is towards the establishment, towards capital, towards the EU, if you like, any of those institutions. And because that's complicated, and because that's complex, and because people are confused by it all, because it seems so big, almost too big to understand, it's so easy to get someone, actually, see that bloke over there, it's his fault. And so punching down is the oldest trick in the book, and it works every time. And working class people fall for it every time. So part of it's our fault too on the left for not, you know, in terms of organizing, in terms of talking, in terms of political education, in terms of getting out and about. But also, you've got these, again, I go back to it, you've got these social media and platforms which are so powerful and so useful in spreading that negative narrative about you know, whatever far right narratives about unvetted men and military, all that bollocks. Everyone knows it's nonsense, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter because it works, and it gives people a place to direct and express their anger. And I understand where that anger comes from. It's just being directed at the wrong people. And then at the same time, you've got a state which, you know, again, I think they're playing a really dangerous game. If you look at asylum seekers, it went from like taking people in from Ukraine is one thing. Ireland accepted, I think, 102,000 so far, but Britain's only accepted 200,000. And there's 60 million people in Britain. Ireland's got 5 million. I mean, percentages, you know, compared to the percent of the population, it's a huge number of people. And what that does is if you take a group of Ukrainian asylum seekers, fast track them, and then almost literally dump them somewhere, which is what the state's doing, they're dumping them in these villages and towns. Of course, you're going to get reaction, right? Whether you like it or not, good or bad. Some of it's good. There have been great reactions and great local organizers to help people and accommodate people. But the state knows what it's doing. It's throwing people into fucking Mayo and into Kerry without the resources to look after those people. And they know what the reaction was going to be. So I don't think they're doing it by mistake, you know.
Yeah.
And they're also doing it to look good in the eyes of the EU, because they love to be, the Irish state loves to be a poster boy for neoliberal EU. So they're absolutely going to bend over backwards to make themselves look like they're important to that institution. But yeah, they're playing fire. They really are, but they're not, it's not a mistake.
Yeah. And I think we, on the left, we really haven't found the right way to have that conversation in terms of acknowledging people's genuine frustration. And also, there's such a fear around perpetuating the idea that asylum seekers and refugees are a drain on resources, that people shy away from talking about the fact that communities are actually under-resourced and are overstretched. And
100%.
And there are communities where it could just be handled so much better. Like one of the articles on RTE, you know, Dáil hears Ross Gray let down by government, but then you see it's Michael Lowry, you know, having that conversation, and you're just like, is that this, like, seriously? We're talking about people being let down by the government, and you know, it's an article led by Michael Lowry, and it's what's really frustrating is that a lot of the people. Now, in fairness, not the only one say it. Like in the article, you have Breed Smith reinforcing the government have caused this. Like they absolutely, even just the lack of, and again, it's this thing about information and consultation. That now we don't want to give the idea that anybody has a right to know about or set or give an opinion on who moves into their community. But if you work with communities, around resources and integration, that's the only way that this is going to work, as much for the people coming into the communities as anybody else. Because what you do have then is right off the bat, like the reason I'm always given for not giving information was that you don't want to give the far right a heads up. The far right know about these things happening before we do. Like that's the reality. Like they know they're outside these centres, and that's the introduction that people are getting. And you have the for all groups that popping up around the country who are stepping in to do that work, stepping in to do welcoming work and, you know, building connections and building community. But the government are absolutely taking a step back and like perpetuating this. And I think
they're not just taking a step back. There's, you know, they know what the result is going to be.
Yeah.
And they're quite happy.
They're
for
allowing
that.
It.
So, yeah. It
benefits them. Like, it absolutely, like, but I think an example as well of what this is then distracting from as well is like, so you had up in Belcombe, just down the road from me, like 85% of a whole housing estate bought up by the One Trust. And it's just like, now it has been a big story, but it should have been, you know, this is the kind of thing that a government should be shut down over. And I feel like years ago, this is the kind of thing that a government could potentially have been brought down over. Like we have a housing crisis. This happened 2 years ago. And, you know, this bullshit 10% stamp duty was brought in to disincentivize. 10% stamp duty is absolutely nothing to these trusts. In real terms, it is so much cheaper for a trust to buy any of these houses than it is for a normal person who's paying interest, who's having to, you know, save a massive deposit, then engage in the, you know, the mortgage system. Like it's already so much cheaper for them. They make such profit on them. 10% is absolutely nothing. They should be banning it outright, first of all. But if not, they should be putting a tax on it that's so high that it is either.
Well, why would they ban it? Why would they ban it? I mean, there's a myth going around that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and establishment parties like that, that somehow they serve the Irish people. They don't. They serve the interests of capital.
Yeah.
So why would they do something that damages the interests of capital and foreign capital in particular to make profits in Ireland and extract wealth from Ireland? I mean, that's what those parties have always existed to do. So we shouldn't be at all surprised that these are their policies, and that then when what happens because of their policies happens, they just, what do? They justify it. They don't turn against it. So that's why those parties exist. What they've done is, in order to cover that, in order to, they're encouraging the growth of the far right, and they're playing with fire, as I said before, because they know that people will be distracted from that wealth extraction, from wealth that is being created, being pulled out. I mean, 50% of people's wages are going on mortgages and rents. More, 60% of people's wages are going on rents, and that money is going to wherever it's going. Foreign capital is going to the top of society. That's why these parties exist. It's they're there to extract wealth from workers to capital, from labor to capital, and if they can have a handy a handy kind of distraction, which is asylum seekers and refugees. And there's a lad jumped out of a fucking van this morning in I think it was Ballsbridge or somewhere in Dublin with a and threatened guards on and threatened guards with a he threatened guards anyway this morning in the papers this morning. And that's a handy distraction when you're stealing people's money. So it's look over here while you're being pickpocketed.
And again, like you said, the punching down, the reason you don't have a house is that there's one building holding 100 asylum seekers down the road, and it's not the 85 houses down the road that's been bought up by a foreign trust. But also, it's very similar to what we were talking about earlier, and that slow creep, similar to the kind of fog of war. There's the media fog around our policies and our politics, because again, 2 years ago, this happened, massive uproar. They were going to ban it, And what did? They introduced a 10% tax. Then a massive story comes out again 2 years later. Like, by the time people cop on and realize that this has happened, there is no space, there's no property, there's no houses left. Like, it's all been bought up. And actually, the majority of our land in this country is owned by foreign capital and massive conglomerates.
And of course, those organizing the far right, not the people on the marches, but those who are organizing it, those who are encouraging it, they support that system. I mean, the far right supports capitalists. They're not socialists, these people. So it suits them to ignore those stories as well and to get people focused on the asylum seekers and on refugees and on migrant workers and on people of color. So that's the danger. But again, none of this is an accident. No, it's a product of ideology. It's a product of people making political choices that suit interests, certain kinds of interests, So I'm far. I mean, if you thought strategically, well, the best way for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to win the next election would be to have a program of house building. But they won't do that because they're ideologically committed to that transfer of wealth. That's it. That's what they believe in.
I do say to people, like, if I hear people slipping into this stuff, and one of the first things I say to them is, okay, so that person that you're sharing or following or whatever, they're attacking Sinn Féin. What does that actually mean? Do they want a Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael government? Because that's, think this through. Like, what does this actually lead to? And who is that benefiting? And it's like such a simple thing like that. It's like, if they're attacking Sinn Féin and the left, like, who are they actually supporting and who are they benefiting? Because they're not getting
The only good thing about some of this far right stuff is that once you let that cat out of the bag, you can't really control it. So what you might find is that people are going to start voting for independence, and they're going to start standing. There's all kinds of lunatics on TikTok.
Oh, yeah.
They're hilarious. Some of these people, real grifters, the ones with like links in the bio, send money to me here, crowdsourcing for my election. But there will be a lot of votes to go in towards that independent group. And all that's going to do really is split the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael vote. And it might not damage the Fáil vote as much as these Fine Gael strategies are open for. Yeah, once you let that out of the bag, it's a hard thing to control, particularly how people, use their votes come election time. So as you said, it's going to be a really interesting year ahead.
Yeah. Do you know what? One thing, just when you mentioned like the EU, obviously there was a really, really devastating story during the week. And it was about how, rape was omitted from the EU directive on violence against women. So like, this is the EU's first directive on combating violence against women and domestic violence. And it won't include the crime of rape because a number of countries, including Ireland, could not agree on a legal definition. I mean, when I say I wanted to bounce my phone off a wall reading that, I just thought, it just shows how far we haven't come, like how little progress actually. Like, sometimes we see these huge socially progressive, and I hate that phrase, socially progressive, but very liberal wins sometimes. And some of them are really important, but they're not rooted in an economic progress, and they're not rooted in a structural change. So actually, when it comes down to it, the same structures are there, which are usually, they're capitalist, they're misogynistic, they're patriarchal. And this is such a pure example of that. And it's like, what are people prioritizing? Where are we trying to get in a situation that we will actually exclude something like rape from violence against women?
It's incredible. When I read that, I had to read it twice, to be honest with you. It shows one of the weaknesses of the EU, of course, in terms of how it creates legislation, how it creates directives. But what it's done is that the EU has been quite positive in terms of social liberalism over the last 15, 20 years. But because it's followed a very neoliberal capitalist road in terms of economics, that's damaged people, that's damaged communities, that's damaged economies, particularly in the periphery of Europe, although that's now damaging economies in the centre of Europe. And so you're getting a kickback. You're getting a really nasty kickback. You're getting the growth of far-right parties, the growth of populism, of social conservatism in particular. And so social conservative parts of Europe that are unhappy with the economic direction of the EU are kicking back against the social liberal side of Europe. So you're getting this really weird dynamic, and that's where that's coming from. And it's damaging the European Union, because the EU's fundamental raison d'etre is a free movement of capital, goods, services, and people. It's not, it's a capitalist bloc, and that kind of social liberal cover, if you like, and that's what it has been to some degree, is falling apart because it's the economic direction of the European Union is floundering. I mean, it's failing. I mean, the German economy is winding down, and that's going to lead to another recession, a recession in Germany. The Ukraine war is not helping, of course, in that regard. So things aren't looking great at all within the European Union. And probably in the next 2 years, we're going to see a majority of not just like socially conservative governments, but far right governments in Europe. That's what we're going to see, and that's going to be the EU. So that model of the social Europe, socially liberal Europe, it's almost dead. I mean, social Europe dead 10, 15 years ago. Only the Irish Labour Party and dickheads I hang on to it as if it means something. It's gone and it's dead. But that socially liberal Europe's on its way out too, and that's a real danger. We have to worry about that, and the direction of the European Union is a right wing one, you know.
Yeah, and I think like for a lot of people, if that wasn't already evident, then Ursula von Leyen coming out and giving Israel free rein at the start of what is now a genocide. If you're talking progress, if you're talking socially progressive, if you're talking the most basic human rights based approach, I mean, that was it really out the window. Like if you can't
What
impose.
Borrell said last year, the 18 months ago, about how that Europe is the garden and we have to fucking go out and tidy the jungle. I mean, that's language from the 19th
That is,
century, the
yeah.
Scramble for Africa kind of stuff, and that's language of 19th century colonialists. So
Yeah, a huge amount of people don't know about Fortress Europe. They don't know about Frontex. They don't actually know that Europe is encouraging the kind of slaughter and funding the slaughter of people who are trying to move from unsafe places in the world seeking safety.
but the biggest contradiction at heart of this is that I do a lot of work in Europe, particularly the European trade unions, and they're there saying, oh my God, why is all this happening? Why is the far right on the rise? And they refuse to look at the very nature of the European Union and the economic direction of the European Union, the neoliberal nature of the EU as the reason. There's a reason why the far right's on the fucking rise. It's not happening because there's a few bad people in the world. It's happening because the economies of those countries are crashing. They're deeply unequal. Wealth is being transferred from labor to capital. People look for answers elsewhere. And it's the right sitting there ready to give them the answers. And the answers are simple answers. It's that black geezer over there. He's the fucking problem. Punch down. Don't worry about what's going on in the stock market or the European Central Bank. So the reason for the rise of the right is the EU itself, you could argue, and its economic direction. That's the reason why. And it doesn't look like it's going to change the direction anytime soon, which means what? It means the far right's going to continue to rise.
Yeah, you shared a great piece of research with me recently, and we can share it on our social media. And it showed that, and it's like it's no surprise to anyone, but it showed that when centre-left parties go into government and uphold and implement austerity, it leads to a massive rise in far right activity and far right electoral support. When the right actually do that, it doesn't. And it just comes back to people feeling let down and feel like, oh, what's the fucking point here? You're not serving my interest, so I'm gonna go over to this person who claims to. And I think we're heading into EU elections as well at the same time as the locals. Claire Daly being such a singular voice sometimes on this stuff shows actually like she is, and she has been attacked for over the years as well. And I think a lot of people are really coming around to see why a voice like hers is absolutely so important in Europe. And I think that her being such a singular voice shows what the EU kind of as an institution really stands for.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's been brilliant the last year, and she's as you say, her voice is quite important in there, and she'll attack the EU for the right reasons, I suppose, and she'll draw out its hypocrisy and its contradictions. I just hope she gets a good run at the seat, because she deserves to be back in that place, and we deserve to have her voice. And she's so
Yeah.
popular internationally, it's incredible, actually.
Yeah.
She's a star in Latin America and places like that. So hopefully she'll get it. Hopefully she'll win that seat again.
Yeah. And one last story I want to touch on, but unless there's anything else you want to throw in, but it is what's happening up north. I mean, I've seen loads of stories about the DUP. I'll be honest, when I see the three letter DUP, I do tend to tune out. But there was an article about Jamie Bryson in RTE and on the Irish Times, and kind of framing him as this leading figure, and even the headline said like even the DUP kind of shudder when they hear Jamie Bryson talking, and I just thought that is bizarre. And it fed right back into how the media fuel the likes of these figures within the far right, particularly down here. But tell us a little bit about what's happening with the DUP in Stormont and
I mean, it's very briefly, it's like Groundhog Day up here. It's just another crisis. And even if this crisis gets solved, we'll wait 18 months and 2 years, and there'll be another crisis. I mean, the executive and the assembly have been out of power more than they've been in power since 1998. That's the thing to remember. I mean, this place is completely dysfunctional. We can never properly function. And I say that somebody works with it and works with the institutions. Of course, we do. We work with parties in there quite a lot, and we're trying to push public policy and get things changed. And you do that on a daily basis in your job, but at the end of the day, you know in the back of your head, no, that's not worth a fuck half the time, because you know there's going to be another collapse in the assembly at some point in the future, and there'll be a number of collapses, and it'll go on for another few years, and eventually, if Shinners win in the south, there might be a border poll, and that's really the next big debate. Is I think everyone knows that the constitutional arrangements are going to change in the near future. Well, not necessarily the near future, but in the future anyway. And so that's the big debate. In terms of Wee Jamie, yeah, him being given a platform like that to anyone who knows the North is just hilarious. We kind of enjoy it. We kind of enjoy him getting that kind of, you know, that kind of respect from the mainstream media. In terms of the North, what's going to happen here in the immediate term, there was a meeting on Friday there just passed. People thought there was going to be an announcement from the DUP that they're going back into the executive and the assembly would be up again, but it didn't happen. And I think Geoffrey Donaldson, it was suggested Donaldson had the votes from his officers of the party to bring them forward, but apparently he doesn't. So it seems that Sammy Sausage Fingers Wilson is still holding the reins of power in there in terms of stopping the executive back up. And, but even if it does get up, it'll be, yeah, it'll be okay for a while, but it'll collapse. It'll collapse again eventually. You know?
Yeah. And I suppose two things on that. Just very briefly, can you explain to people who don't understand it? Because I have a sense of an understanding, but I don't think even on a ground level I'd understand. What does it mean when the executive isn't, when Stormont isn't sitting and the executive isn't functioning? Like, does it impact like services running? Does it impact, you know, organisations access and funding? Does it have a practical impact?
That, yeah, not all of that. When the things close down, it has a massive impact. I mean, we had a strike last Thursday, you know, we had 170,000 public workers on strike last Thursday, biggest strike in the history of this place. I think it's probably since partition, a huge strike. It didn't include all the unions, but all the ones that work in, most of the ones work in public sector in the health service. And a huge turnout. There's a great dynamic. It was a real good demo in Belfast because people haven't had a pay rise in years and people are really struggling here. The NHS is on its knees in the six counties, genuinely on its knees. You'd be afraid to get ill and have to go to the A&E at the moment. I mean, I think that in Belfast last week, there was 340 people waiting in A&E. It's fallen apart. And the Brits, the British government, you know, they're holding money over the heads of the DUP saying, look, you know, please go back. If you go back in, we'll give you this money and you can solve all your problems. But there are serious problems here economically and socially and every other way. So, and it does have an impact. I mean, it is a region and you do need a functioning executive, you know, but long term it'll collapse again. So that's the nature of the dysfunctional nature of it. The only difference this time, and it is a big difference, is that there's a nationalist majority in the North. You know, Michelle is going to be potentially first minister when it gets up and running again. And that's a huge demographic shift. And if you were a unionist, that means something, I think. That means, you know, because it's no longer, hasn't been for a while, but it certainly isn't an orange state. It's not even a majority Protestant unionist state anymore. So that changes things as well. And it kind of suggests to people there's only one direction of travel here. And that's the backstory to all of this, you know, that this changes the direction of travel for the North.
And you mentioned, though, the NHS. I mean, for a long time, the NHS was always raised as a reason why people wouldn't vote for a border poll. It was like, why would we join your health service? And obviously, like, when we had Skullcush Glee back in September last year, we had huge conversations around that conversation and how even that premise that the North would join the dysfunctional South, you know, is so far from what we need to be having. And that's the big fear, isn't it? It's that actually what might happen is, you know, a border poll happens and there's this rush to push it through. There's this rush to get something over the line that we don't give the time and space and the right people aren't involved in designing that we have a real conversation about a new 42 county socialist republic.
The last thing you want to see is bolting together two failed states or a failed state and a failed statelet to give the North proper designation. You don't want to see that happening, but that's the most likely of all of the scenarios because, you know, we don't know when it'll happen or if it happens or whatever, but if the direction of travel happens and there is a border poll, and once the Brits call one, it has to happen every 7 years after that. So it's kind of inevitable once it's called. But yeah, I mean, a new Ireland would have to be negotiated. And the only people really talking about it at the moment are the middle classes and the bourgeoisie with that, in that new Ireland sort of forum. I mean, I know there's a small trade union group, Trade Unions for United Ireland, that meets and does a little bit of work, but there's no left debate outside of Sinn Féin talking about it yet. And there kind of needs to be. There needs to be. That debate needs to be happening, of course.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of things we need to do.
I had a group of four sort of people up here last week on a kind of delegation to Trademark, and one of them asked, what would the future government of Ireland look like, you know, after unification? I said, well, probably permanent Sinn Féin and DUP government, so good luck with that. The most likely scenario, isn't it, Lionel?
Yeah. But even on trade unionism, because just, like, we usually try to end with some good news stories, and I'll be honest, it's very hard to see good news around us at the minute. It's very hard to think of anything, certainly for me. I think it's very hard to think of anything but Gaza and what's happening to the Palestinian people. Because just briefly touching back on something we said earlier on as well, and it was around Netanyahu, who he came out and he basically said it doesn't matter what the ICJ say, that they will continue. And it's like, what does that mean for the world? Like, the institutions of the world basically are meaningless when that happens. And it's like, people should care enough about what's happening in Gaza, but they don't. If you're missing an empathy chip and you don't, you'd think self-interest would kind of push people into this space a little bit. So what I will say in terms of slightly positive or hopeful news is the levels of mobilization we're seeing in people. And I think people who listen to this podcast are already mobilizing. But if not, you know, get out to an action, get out to a protest, get out to a direct action. If you're already protesting and marching, go to a direct action, go to some civil disobedience. Just try to step up whatever you're doing and try to imagine that if this was happening in this country now, if it was happening an hour down the road, what would you do? You know, if you knew that 10 kids every day were having amputations without anesthetic. Like, I was watching something last night, like a drama and historical thing, and someone was getting their leg amputated. And I just blurted out watching it, 10 kids a day are actually going through this in Gaza. If that doesn't make you want to just be doing something 24/7, I don't know what possibly could. So yeah, get out, you know, organize, resist, join a direct action, join a group, make sure you're talking about it on social media. At the very least, be going on and amplifying the stories of people in Gaza. We do actually have power when enough people get out on the streets, and the media won't report. They won't report there was 100,000 people on the streets last week. But everybody that was there and everybody that came to a march for the first time, because it was a big campaign to get new people there last week, and that happened, they will come again. They will get involved in something else. And we're seeing loads of new groups popping up. Like, I'm involved in a group now, Mothers Against Genocide. It started up in Belfast. Ali was down last week at the rally, and I
Yeah,
met
I'm
with a
not
few of them. They're so organized. They're really impressive. Like, I have to say, like, I'm seeing so many new groups who've never been involved in organizing our activism before getting activated. And I think that's what we have to be focused on. We have to be focused
Well,
on
the
going
other,
into
yeah,
communities.
I mean, the other thing to focus on as well is that it's not to be overly Eurocentric about this as well. I mean, the rest of the planet is against US imperialism. The rest of the planet is against what Israel's doing. I mean, the ICJ case, the ICC case. I know that the international kind of institutions, that the rules-based order, so-called, is, you know, it's not dead in the water. It's been undermined over the last 20 years, particularly since 2001, since 9/11. But those things are still functioning. Give them your support, share them online, and also remember that, you know, other parts of the planet are with us on this one. This is not just about, you know, us versus fucking Israel or anyone versus all the rest of the planet votes against that state all of the time. The rest of the planet wants to see a Palestinian state emerge. And so we're in the majority here. We don't
Well,
have the
and
power
who do we want to
necessarily to.
stand with? So, like,
Exactly.
Varadkar has been saying, you know, we're more effective working within the EU and we don't want to operate unilaterally. Like, that's the argument being against, say, joining the ICJ case. If you look at the motion that was taken and that was approved in Europe only a couple of days ago, it was a shockingly bad motion. I mean, it was horrific. It was more supportive of Israel than it was of the Palestinian people. I think that alone is an argument for us to step away and now act unilaterally. There's no excuses anymore. But like you said, there are people around the world that we are much more aligned with than most of the EU states. And
100%.
that's where we need to be looking. So yeah,
100%.
get activated, get organized, and don't stop talking about it on social media.
Just and people know this as well, and people listen to this podcast know this, but because of my job, we do spend a lot of time traveling and that. And anywhere you go in the world, people fucking love Ireland for this. Not the state, but the Irish people and their 100% support for. I remember talking to some comrades who come over from another country and they said, "What's the left like in Ireland?" I says, "Well, that's complicated and this, you know, blah, blah, blah." I says, "But the one thing," I said, "there is one thing that unites the left in Ireland on a 32 county basis, and that's 100% support for Palestine, and, you know, no conditions attached." So, people should remind themselves of that we're, you know, that people like to see the stance that the Irish people and the Irish left is taking. So that's why it's important to continue doing it.
And the Palestinian people, like, we see Palestinian people all the time kind of talking about and recognizing Irish solidarity, but a lot of us, you know, we're obviously organizing up until last week's national demo. I don't think I slept in about 3 days, but just with the weight of feeling like this is a singular opportunity because of what Varadkar had said this really negative kind of almost supportive of Israel stance, and it was like, here's an opportunity for the Irish people to remind him what we stand for. That Tadhg Hickey had done a reel on it, and Motaz had shared it with this really emotional. I just was blown, like, I really broke
Just do
down
that.
seeing that, because it was like the Palestinian people know that we're not forgetting them. They know that we're trying everything we can, we're taking to the streets, and that alone is enough of a reason to be making sure that you're out every single day you can. So Yeah, let's keep doing it. Thanks a million again to Stefan and Eolan today for joining us in Trademark Belfast. This has been the Week at Work. We will be back with you next week. In the meantime, if you can share our socials, The Week at Work and Left Block on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and TikTok. Stevie has a TikTok account actually. If you want to throw out your TikTok handle there, Stevie, for people to follow you.
Do I really want to do that? Okay, it's Anulani, but they won't. It's Anulaniaigh, Anulani, which means the
Okay.
Nolan, by the way, the Nolan, not a Nolan, but fucking the Nolan.
Yeah, and you'll get some Irish language content in there as well. So yeah, this is the Week at Work. You can support us on Patreon. That's www.patreon.com/leftblock, and that's leftblock.se, and we will see you next week.